KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
The president campaigned on mass deportations, and he wants to use the Alien Enemies Act to make good on those promises. But the Supreme Court stepped in again today to block those efforts. We'll hear why. For Saturday, April 19th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. Almost 200 countries have signed on to an agreement to share data and vaccines if there's another pandemic, but the U.S. isn't one of them.
When the U.S. announced its withdrawal, it was quite clear that it's a loss.
We'll dig deep into Elon Musk's favorite social media account and how that Australian crypto entrepreneur is capitalizing on the attention. And we go to Maine, where one group is helping older men connect with each other.
We kind of, as a stereotype, have this idea that men are okay. That's a stereotype that's wrong.
First, news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed not to allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon. He made the statement in a pre-recorded message that aired on Israeli TV today. It comes on the same day that Iran and the U.S. wrapped up a second round of indirect talks aimed at discussing Iran's nuclear program. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi has more.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would not give up or back down on preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. His statement came hours after Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi and U.S. Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff met in Rome for a second round of indirect talks mediated by Oman. After the talks, the Omani Foreign Ministry said that the two sides agreed to enter a next phase aimed at reaching a deal that would lift U.S. sanctions on Iran and allow the country to develop, quote, peaceful nuclear energy only. Last week, President Trump said Israel would lead in any military action against Iran to prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Large crowds filled a Birmingham, Alabama park today to take part in nationwide protests against the actions by the Trump administration. Noel Ananin of member station WBHM in Birmingham has more.
Up with liberation.
Protesters chanted, sang along to a cover of This Land Is Your Land by Woody Guthrie, and booed recent moves made by the Trump administration. Several attendees, including Carol Bender, say they worry that the president is behaving like a dictator and ignoring the law.
I'm here today to protect and to save our democracy. What's been going on under this administration is frightening.
The Birmingham protesters were joined by others across the nation taking part in hundreds of rallies and similar events. For NPR News, I'm Noelle Ananin in Birmingham.
Shein and Temu, two online retailers famous for bargains shipped from China, are warning about rising prices. They're facing a major shakeup of how they do business thanks to U.S. trade changes. NPR's Alina Selyuk has more.
Shein and Temu built their U.S. businesses around a tax loophole, which allowed them to send clothes and home goods to American shoppers totally duty-free. That's unlike most retailers who tend to ship in bulk from overseas to a U.S. warehouse and pay import taxes. Shein and Temu ship straight from China to your door, and they get an exemption meant for small packages, no import tax. Many groups and companies and bipartisan politicians have long called for this loophole to close. President Biden began that. President Trump is ending it. And that means Shein and Temu will soon have to pay tariffs up to 145%. And the companies say their prices will start going up after April 25th. Alina Seluk, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. This Easter, a small town in Tennessee is celebrating their 200th annual egg fight competition. For member station WETS, Chad Barrett says the egg fight started as a competition between two farming families.
The Peters Hollow Egg Fight in Elizabethton began in the early 1800s. Event organizer Jamie Peters told me it all started when residents of nearby Hollers
got in a debate on whose chickens laid the hardest eggs.
Egg Fight contestants sit in a circle and tap eggs top and bottom with the person beside them until the winner remains with an unbroken egg. Only hen eggs are allowed, but longtime host Norman Peters says people have gotten crafty over the years.
We've had a couple of questionable eggs, like guinea eggs.
Because of their hard shells, Peter says you couldn't break a guinea egg with a rock. For NPR News, I'm Chad Barrett in Johnson City.
President Trump says he will allow commercial fishing in one of the world's largest ocean reserves, saying he wants to make the U.S. the world's dominant seafood leader. But the area, west of Hawaii, has many endangered species, including whales and sea turtles, tropical seabirds, and coral. Trump issued the executive order opening up the Pacific Islands Heritage Marine National Monument about 750 miles west of Hawaii, and in another EO, ordered the Commerce Department to loosen regulations on commercial fishing. The Trump administration says that this move to open up the area for commercial fishing will help that industry, but some disagree, saying protected areas can allow space for fish to spawn more successfully. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks, in for Scott Detrow. President Donald Trump has moved at a fast pace to enact his immigration agenda, including his promise of mass deportations. But the strategy has also left the administration in the midst of several legal battles, including with the Supreme Court. NPR's immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo is with me now. Hi, Jimena.
Hey, Miles.
So let's start with the immediate developments. Overnight, the Supreme Court issued an order against the president. What did that say?
Well, the justice issued an order stopping the administration from using the Alien Enemies Act to remove people currently held at the Blue Bonnet Detention Facility in Texas. The order came just after midnight Eastern, and only two judges, Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, dissented.
And why that specific detention center?
So yesterday, the American Civil Liberties Union caught wind that there were migrants detained there who were receiving forms titled Notice and Warrant of Apprehension and Removal under the Alien Enemies Act. The ACLU and other legal organizations quickly filed documents with the D.C. District Court. They said that their clients got the forms, which alleged that they're members of the Tren de Aragua Venezuelan gang, and that immigration officers told them that they would be deported within the next day. Now, a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court had ruled that the administration could use the Alien Enemies Act to deport people, but it had to ensure that those people got due process and the chance to contest allegations, such as claims that they're members of a gang. The ACLU argues that there wasn't anything on those forms that indicate how those people could challenge the deportation, nor enough time to do so. So they asked D.C. Judge James Boasberg to issue a temporary restraining order on the use of the act. But Boasberg denied the motion, saying he didn't believe he had the jurisdiction to do so since he's in D.C. So the groups appealed to the Supreme Court.
It does feel like the Alien Enemies Act is becoming a big part of the immigration battle right now. Can you just remind us why the administration wants to use it?
The Alien Enemies Act is a wartime power that the president can invoke. Trump did so last month, and it previously has mostly been used in times of actual declared war. The last time it was used was during World War II. Basically, the act allows the administration to streamline deportations and forego the regular immigration court process. And that would be beneficial for Trump because he wants to speed up these deportations and removals, and immigration court can take months or even years. The ACLU and other groups have been pushing back against the use of the act. They argue that this is a way that the administration is implementing it. There's just no due process. Even when it was last used, there was at least a hearing board that could hear someone's case as to why they shouldn't be removed. The Supreme Court is allowing the administration to use the act, at least for now, and it told the ACLU that if they want to fight it, they need to do so individually. So various lawsuits have been filed across district courts, some of which have blocked the administration from using this strategy with folks who are being held in detention centers within the geographic jurisdiction of those courts. Now, let's circle back to Blue Bonnet, right, that facility in Texas. The ACLU argues that the administration was trying to move people there because it's one of the detention centers in Texas that is currently not blocked. The administration, though, is denying that that is their strategy.
Right, and we should note that late today, the administration officially asked the Supreme Court to reject the legal efforts to stop the deportations from that facility in Texas. So we'll see what the Supreme Court ultimately does. But Jimena, another key theme this week is how the administration is using El Salvador as a tool in the effort to increase removals. What is that looking like now?
So the use of the Alien Enemies Act has been slowed because of many of those district court decisions and, of course, last night's Supreme Court decision. But there are other ways that the administration is sending people to Secot. That's the notorious mega prison in El Salvador where over 100 people removed with the Alien Enemies Act were last taken. They're still sending some select flights from the U.S. With those they allege are members of gangs. And this has been spurred by the growing alliance between Trump and Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele. Bukele has said that he wants to expand this facility as well.
I think with all of the different, it almost feels like every single day we're getting a new something from some court regarding immigration right now. Can you take a step back and just talk about how this administration's entire immigration policy agenda is overall being received by courts?
I mean, it definitely is a bit of a mixed bag. They've had some wins and they've also had some losses. Several of their efforts have been blocked by or are still stuck in litigation with the courts. One big example of this is that day one executive order to impose restrictions on birthright citizenship. Remember that? Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court has set oral arguments on a trio of cases challenging that for next month. The administration has also received temporary restraining orders for now blocking its attempts to revoke parole status for over 500,000 Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans that were about to lose their status. But as we've also been discussing, they have seen some wins, like the approval to utilize Alien Enemies Act, at least for now, or the green light to ensure that everyone in the U.S. without legal status has to register with the federal government. There is more to see about how far the administration goes and how the judicial branch as a whole navigates the new policies that Trump wants to implement.
Well, thank you, NPR immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo, for tracking all of this for us. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Syria has some of the most important archaeological sites in the Middle East. They include the ancient Roman city of Palmyra, badly damaged over years of civil war and ISIS occupation, but once again accessible after the fall of the regime. NPR's Jane Araf traveled there to see what's left. And a warning to listeners, this includes the sound of gunfire.
You can hear militia gunfire in the distance in these deserted ruins of Palmyra. Once on the Silk Road between Asia and Europe, the city is one of Syria's most important archaeological sites. In the last decade, it became a battleground, damaged by the militant group ISIS and by Syrian regime and Russian forces who fought them. Mahmoud Batman, a fighter with a militia that has controlled Palmyra along with government forces since the fall of the Syrian regime, shows us the damage. The spot where we are standing was the Baal Shamin Temple, 2,000 years old, dedicated to a god of the sky and one of the most prominent features of the Roman city. ISIS considered Palmyra's pre-Islamic civilization blasphemous. It beheaded Palmyra's chief archaeologist, Khalid al-Assad, and then the group methodically blew up parts of the city. Batman shows us a video taken before ISIS arrived. The Baal Shamin Temple towering over the site.
Before.
Oh, gosh, before it was almost completely intact. It was a big square building with intact pillars, and now it's just giant blocks lying on top of each other. Palmyra is listed by the UN Cultural Organization as a World Heritage Site. At its height, ruled by the powerful Queen Zenobia, 200,000 people lived here. You can imagine how this was just a huge, thriving city at one point. I mean, the scale of it. This was one of the centers of the Silk Road. There would have been caravans coming from east and west. And you still get that sense of grandeur. But with everything that's been destroyed here, you get more of a sense of what's been lost.
In 2016, Syrian regime forces backed by Iranian militias and Russian troops took back Palmyra and damaged more of it in the process, according to Syrian antiquities officials.
Is that a helmet?
We walk through a Russian military base built near the ruins.
The ground is covered with what look like burnt documents, all blackened. There's some books in Russian that are partially burned, that are lying here soaked in water. Looks like there's pieces of computer equipment and what looks like an artillery shell.
Nearby, on one of the colonnaded streets, young volunteers are rolling stone blocks to prevent cars from driving into the ruins. There's been immense looting of archaeological sites in Syria. We have to take care of even the small pieces, says Mahmoud Shakir from the Palmyra Youth Gathering. Bringing tourists back will take a lot of work. At the century-old Zenobia Hotel, where writer Agatha Christie stayed, the ground is covered in shattered glass. There are bullet holes in the walls. A waterlogged drinks menu is a remnant of the hotel's happier days. Inside the modern city, almost every building has been damaged during the 13 years of civil war and ISIS rule. A 14-year-old volunteer, Zain Sagir, tells us they've been cleaning debris and painting sidewalks to prepare for visitors again. The city changed hands twice between ISIS and the Syrian regime from 2015 to 2017. 90% of the population here was displaced, many of them to camps. There are signs of life returning, a bit of construction, vegetable stalls in the streets. But few people have the money to rebuild. There are no emergency services here, and hardly any electricity. Shakir, who's 24, says they will restore the ancient city and rebuild the modern one. But the young people, the children lost, that is the most devastating destruction, he says. That we cannot change. Jane Arath, NPR News, Palmyra, Syria.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Russian President Putin announced a temporary 30-hour ceasefire in its war with Ukraine. But Ukrainian President Zelensky says military commanders report that Russian assaults and artillery fire continue. Meanwhile, the two countries each exchanged hundreds of prisoners. Both sides appear to want to show they have an interest in peace talks in the face of an increasingly impatient President Trump. In cities around the U.S., protesters turned out at hundreds of rallies and events, again taking aim at the Trump administration and what they say is a threat to the nation's democratic ideals. This 2 weeks after a similar protest drew thousands. And organizers in Massachusetts expect hundreds of thousands of visitors this weekend for events honoring the 250th anniversary of the beginning of the Revolutionary War. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. 30 years ago today, just as people were getting ready for their workday in downtown Oklahoma City, bombs planted inside a rental truck outside the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building exploded, killing 168 people, including 19 children. Hundreds more were injured, and it remains the deadliest domestic terrorist attack in U.S. history. Anna Pope with member station KOSU was at the annual remembrance ceremony this morning, and she joins us now. Hi, Anna.
Hello.
So take us back 30 years ago. Tell us about that morning in 1995.
Well, on April 19th, 1995, it was a beautiful morning. Children were attending daycare in the building center. Hundreds of people were just going about their day. A third of the building was blown to bits, and more than 300 nearby buildings were damaged or destroyed. Within minutes, the community came together and responded to the bombing. Timothy McVeigh, who parked the truck, and his accomplice, Terry Nichols, were responsible for the attack and radicalized by anti-government ideology. Where the building once stood is the Oklahoma City National Memorial, and beside it is the museum. It's a place of remembrance of the people who were killed, those who survived, and many more affected. It's also a place for people to understand the impact of political violence.
Yeah, I've heard that memorial is very powerful. Can you tell us who came out this morning?
Our day began at the first church near the memorial. It can seat about 1,200 people in the sanctuary, and it was packed with family members, survivors, and community members. Then we took 168 seconds as a moment of silence for all those who were killed, along with the reading each name of those lost. I met Kent Harville at the memorial. He was sergeant in the Oklahoma City Police Department and crime scene investigator who responded to the attack. He says today was touching and says people who go to the city need to visit the memorial.
It's just a real meaningful place. A lot of lives are lost here. A lot of lives are affected. It's just something people need to see, something they need to remember.
30 years ago, he helped in the recovery efforts, and today he was once again here to remember.
I know former President Bill Clinton was also at the ceremony. Anna, can you tell us what he said?
Yeah, there's a remembrance ceremony every year, and this year there was music, speeches from public officials, including former President Bill Clinton, who was in office at the time. He says those who carried out the bombing believed it would cause a nationwide upheaval against the American government, but instead people came together working in service, honor, and kindness, and rebuilt. This is what's called the Oklahoma Standard.
You made a different decision. So my advice to America today is that we were there for you when you needed us. America needs you, and America needs the Oklahoma Standard. And if we all lived by it, we'd be a lot better off.
He talked about how the country became more polarized in recent years and how this was the center of polarization 30 years ago. Other speakers like Oklahoma City Mayor David Holt also talked about the impact of political violence when we dehumanize each other, and he warned about the dangers of extremism.
That's Anna Pope with KOSU in Oklahoma City. Thank you.
Thank you, Miles.
This week, more than 190 member states of the World Health Organization finalized a treaty to help prevent the next pandemic. It's the first agreement of its kind in the world. Countries have agreed to share data, technology, and vaccines in the event of another disease outbreak. It took more than 3 years of negotiations before the pandemic treaty was finalized, and it was done without the U.S.'s involvement after President Trump announced his intention to pull the U.S. out of the WHO when he took office. Here to tell us more about the talks and the treaty is Precious Matsotso. She's the former Director General of the South African National Department of Health, and she served as co-chair of the group tasked with creating the treaty. Welcome, Precious, to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So I'm sure this gets in the weeds really quickly, but I'm hoping to kind of talk about the broad strokes of what all of these countries agree to in this treaty. Let's start there.
Well, I think the first thing is that they agreed to having prevention measures. As you know, prevention was weak during the COVID pandemic, but also countries were ill-prepared. So the preparedness measures are actually enhanced in this pandemic agreement. The second is provisions for ensuring equitable access to pandemic health-related products. And these are vaccines, diagnostics, as well as therapeutics. But in addition, there's a very important provision, and this has to do with pathogen access and benefit sharing. As you know, there's always been some biological materials and information that are shared during pandemics. In this regard, those who share these biological materials are of the view that it is important that they should also benefit.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because the pathogen access and benefit sharing seems to be, to me, one of the most interesting parts of this treaty, because I know in the past, right, countries have had an issue with sort of giving up information on pathogens and not feeling like they were then rewarded or something with access to the medicines that came from giving that information. Can you explain that a little bit more?
When there's an outbreak, particularly of a pathogen of unknown origin, it is very important to quickly characterize it, how it is spread, how virulent it is. So for that to happen, there must be timely access to that pathogen. That's the first thing. But the argument is that it cannot just be sharing of the pathogen, biological materials or information. There must also be benefits that are accrued from that.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me, especially in theory. But I guess I wonder, once we're down the road, whether it's in a few years or decades, how will some of these decisions that that you all came to over the course of these years of negotiations, how will they actually be enforced when things like they're back in March or February or April of 2020, when things are kind of going crazy in the beginning of one of these moments? How will this treaty actually be enforced?
Well, there are a number of institutional arrangements that have been considered. The first one is that of creating a conference of parties that will be a governance body. The second is having a global logistics network that is supposed to ensure that the products move across different parts of the world, across different regions. As you know, different regions also have their own mechanisms. So you need a network that ensures that there's some information exchange across different regions, different countries, so that at any point in time, you have a fair understanding of where the quantities are and where the of vaccines, huge quantities, oversupply, stockpiles, so that this can be matched against where the need is.
So how did it impact negotiations when the United States announced their intention to pull out of the WHO earlier this year?
The United States has played a very important role during negotiations. As I can confirm, U.S. has the best experts in the world, and they were able to bring these experts when needed to guide and advise and bring a technical knowledge to the discussions, which were quite valuable. In fact, when the U.S. Announced its withdrawal, it was quite clear that it's a loss. It's a loss because the whole institutional and intellectual capital that the U.S. has will be lost. But of course, we do know that countries have their national interests. It is for that reason that when you have an agreement, any treaty or convention, there'll always be provisions that allow for reservations. And our view was that one would have thought that the U.S. would have joined and only reserved in those areas where they were uncomfortable, rather than just withdrawing completely from the negotiations. It is unfortunate.
Can I ask kind of broadly, as you think about ahead of whenever the next pandemic does occur, how confident are you that the response will be better than what we saw with COVID?
You know, I'm quite confident, and coming from the African region, which has been hit by multiple crises, pandemics, outbreaks, epidemics, and natural disasters happening all at once, we've seen the kind of response. And the recent example is a beautiful one, actually, that of Rwanda dealing with a outbreak, a Marburg, and they were able to deal with this in less than 100 days. And we're beginning to see that trend in other countries. So I'm very confident that countries will respond appropriately.
That's global health expert Precious Matsotso, who worked on this new pandemic treaty. Thank you so much, Precious, for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Self-reliance is a core American trait, and men in particular embrace it. So how do you offer help to someone who doesn't think they need it? Ashley Milne-Tite has more from the coast of Maine. And a warning, this story mentions suicide statistics.
Maine has the oldest population in the country. Jess Mara is executive director of the Maine Council on Aging. She says getting older can be challenging for everyone, including men.
We kind of, as a stereotype, have this idea that men are okay. That's a stereotype that's wrong.
Men over 75 have the highest suicide rate in the U.S. There are many reasons for this, says Mary Gagnon of NAMI Maine, a mental health nonprofit. Among them are loss, sickness, the perception of being a drain on others.
For men, being a burden is really difficult for them.
And social isolation. But, she says,
the enemy of suicide is connection.
One effort to connect older men with others is happening in Harpswell, Maine, a coastal community, where volunteering is big, especially around food.
And then we've got American Chop Suey here, if you'd like to see that.
It all started when this volunteer-led group, Harpswell Aging at Home, noticed men were missing from a lot of their activities. Then drivers for their homemade food delivery service encountered many single older men who didn't get out or cook. Here's volunteer Sari Hardcastle.
So they're eating cereal or hot dogs or a peanut butter sandwich, and that's not a very good long-term solution.
She grabbed another volunteer, Tom Mahoney, and tasked him with coming up with something that would get men out and socializing with other guys. Mahoney says he had to be careful how he framed the idea.
If we said it was a support group for men, they're not going to come. Because it would indicate or say to them, I'm vulnerable, I need this. And we don't want to be perceived as being vulnerable.
He and others landed on a monthly lunch named Romeo, retired older men eating out. He got the idea from other grassroots Romeo groups around the country. The latest lunch had around 55 guys in attendance. One of them is Sam Powers. He's traveled all over the world. He's now 80, lives alone, and he had a stroke last summer, which has affected his voice.
Would you describe yourself as quite independent?
Oh, yes, stubbornly, stupidly independent.
Powers says he's met two or three new people at each lunch, and this is as close as he'll get to saying the lunches help him. As we drive away from Powers' apartment, Mahoney says there's nothing wrong with men being self-reliant.
But we still have a need, like anyone else, to be connected to people. That's what he was missing, but wasn't saying.
Jim Hayes isn't going to say it either. He's a lifelong Mainer and retired harbor master of nearby Bailey Island. He now attends the free Romeo lunches, too.
We men, we've worked all our lives, and it's hard to get out of the chair and to get involved with something. You know, we lose our contacts with the outside world, and it takes something like this to pull us back in.
But he says the pulling is going well. Sari Hardcastle agrees. She says the Romeo men are going on to get together at other times.
It's very, very exciting. It's doing just what we wanted it to do. and just what all the research says is needed.
To encourage older men to become healthier and less isolated through human connection. For NPR News, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite.
If you or someone you know is experiencing a crisis, you can call or text 988. Just those three numbers, 988, for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. You're listening to NPR News. Across the country, thousands of anti-administration protesters returned to the streets today. Since President Trump took office, there's been a wave of nationwide demonstrations against his plans and policies. Take a listen to the scene outside the White House today in Lafayette Square.
Show me what democracy looks like!
This is what democracy looks like!
We're joined now in studio by NPR's Juliana Kim, who is at two protests here in Washington. Hi, Juliana.
Hi there.
So tell us a little bit about these protests. What were they about?
So these rallies were organized by the 50-51 movement, which stands for 50 protests in 50 states and one movement. If they sound familiar, it's because they were behind the hundreds of rallies held at state capitals in February on President's Day. Organizers say the purpose of the protest movement is to defend democracy and the Constitution and to speak out against government overreach.
So you've been going to a number of these protests in recent weeks. What was the energy like today?
You know, it seems like large numbers of people are continuing to turn out. According to organizers, today hundreds of rallies again were scheduled around the country. I went to two protests today, and at both of them, I met people who said this is a new chapter for them, and they haven't been this politically active in a long time. I spoke with Andy Carpenter at the protest in Lafayette Square, and he told me that he never really attended a protest before Trump got elected for a second term, but now he calls this a new job of his.
But as we build consensus, as we build discipline, as we begin to express more and more and more strongly that what this country is about and what is unacceptable, that's going to have an impact.
Another protester, Erin Gary, said she's also coming out regularly in order to motivate those around her.
I'm coming out just as an act of awareness and maybe to help embolden friends and neighbors. If you see one person stand up, there's strength in numbers. Solidarity matters.
Others told me that they hope these rallies will pressure lawmakers into standing up against Trump. I also want to add the White House hasn't responded to a request for comment on these protests, but the president has repeatedly said the country supports what he's doing.
Right. Well, it does seem obvious to me that the people in D.C. might be kind of politically motivated, but what have you heard about events around the country?
Well, here's a sample from one protester, Sue Finney from Lexington, Kentucky. When asked what impact she hopes these demonstrations will have, she told member station WEKU this.
I hope people see the number of people that are coming together to stand together. Even though we may not have common ground on everything, we have a common ground that we believe that our country needs to be protected, our rights need to be protected, and that we need to continue to be a democracy for all people.
Other member stations reported rallies in Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Cincinnati, Birmingham, just to name a few. I should note that there were mass protests during Trump's first term. And, you know, we don't know how these rallies will continue to take shape. But the protesters I spoke to said they plan to keep coming out for months on end.
That's NPR's Juliana Kim. Thank you so much, Juliana.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
In The Shrouds, director David Cronenberg tells the story of a man who can't seem to let go of his wife after her death, but his grief takes an extreme, visceral form.
For him, her death was a physical event,
And so he's naturally focused on what he has left of her, her body.
That conversation Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The Supreme Court has ordered the Trump administration not to deport a group of Venezuelan men held in North Texas under an 18th century wartime law for now. The administration alleges the men are gang members. The ACLU sued, saying the men had a right to have their cases heard in court. A second round of talks between the U.S. and Iran in Rome ended today as both sides try to ease growing tensions over Iran's nuclear ambitions. Next week, a group will meet to discuss technical details, including the size of nuclear stockpiles Iran could amass and how compliance could be monitored and verified. And NASA's Lucy spacecraft is heading toward another close encounter with an asteroid. Tomorrow's expected flyby will be Lucy's second asteroid encounter since the spacecraft was launched in 2021. I'm Janine Herbst. NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card, VentureX. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. The U.S. and Iran have concluded a second round of talks on Tehran's nuclear program with an agreement to meet again in a week's time. The two sides gathered today in Rome, and the talks are being mediated by Oman. President Trump says he wants to prevent Iran from ever having a nuclear weapon, and he's indicated he's willing to give these negotiations a bit of time. We're joined now by NPR's international affairs correspondent, Jackie Northam, to tell us a little bit more. Hey, Jackie.
Hi, Miles.
So tell us what we know about the second round of negotiations here.
Well, the meeting took place at Oman's embassy in Rome, and this was the second time in as many weeks that they've met after, you know, years of having no direct talks between the two countries. The U.S. side was led by President Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, represented Iran, and he told Iranian TV after the four-hour meeting the talks were good and held in a constructive manner. But Araghchi gave no specific details about what was discussed.
It does seem to me that things seem to be going well just by the fact that they have agreed to meet again for a third round of talks next weekend. Can you talk us through what the end game is here?
Well, after their first meeting last week, U.S. envoy Witkoff said that Iran could enrich uranium to a low-grade level to produce energy. And then a couple days later, he turned around and said Iran must stop and eliminate its nuclear enrichment. So it's a little unclear what the U.S. is willing to accommodate. But, you know, Iran has been firm that it will not give up what it insists is its right to enrich uranium for civilian use. Other than that, Iran may be looking for sanctions relief. You know, during his first term in office, Trump pulled out of the previous nuclear accord, which had been negotiated by President Obama, and he placed crippling sanctions on Iran, which has just hobbled its economy. So getting out from under that may be one thing that Iran is looking for in these talks and perhaps can help reach a compromise.
But considering the weakened economy point and also some recent military setbacks, is Iran really in a position where they're going to be willing to compromise?
Oh, you're right. You know, Iran is not in a position of strength right now. Since the start of the Gaza war 18 months ago, Israel has decimated Iran's main proxies, Hezbollah and Hamas. And it took out key Iranian air defenses when the two countries traded missile and airstrikes last year for the first time ever. And the U.S. has been carrying out frequent strikes on the Houthis, which are also aligned with Iran. You know, there's also speculation that Israel may want to launch its own strike against Iran's nuclear targets. And President Trump appeared to confirm a report in the New York Times that he'd held off such a strike that was proposed, according to the report, by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he visited the White House recently. And I just want to say that NPR hasn't been able to independently verify that reporting yet.
Right, but it does signal some openness here to kind of letting these negotiations play out, seemingly. Can we, right. What are we expecting next week as these kind of talks continue?
Well, analysts I've spoken to expect Iran will try to drag out these talks for as long as possible without making any real concessions, since they're negotiating from a position of weakness and don't want to give too much that would make them look even weaker than they are. But President Trump has made it clear the clock is ticking, and we understand there's a meeting on a technical level during this upcoming week, and that's before Witkoff and Arachi are due to meet in Oman next weekend. You know, that's raised hopes that they might be able to get some traction on these talks and avoid the possibility of a conflict. But, you know, it's a very complicated process.
That's NPR's Jackie Northam. Thank you so much, Jackie.
Thank you.
For more than 50 years, the Endangered Species Act protected imperiled species habitats from destruction. The Trump administration proposed a rule on Wednesday to change the interpretation of a key word in the law. NPR's Jonathan Lambert has more.
The word take lies at the heart of the Endangered Species Act. The law prohibits the take of endangered species and defines the word as anything that harasses, harms, or kills a species. For decades, the government has interpreted harm broadly to include harm to habitats. The reason why is clear to Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity.
Because, like, if you're destroying habitat and as a result you're injuring or killing wildlife, that is harmful.
But now the Trump administration wants to redefine harm more narrowly. Under the proposed rule, harming habitats would no longer mean that you're harming a species. Conservation experts say that could be devastating.
Habitat loss is the biggest single cause of extinction and endangered species, you know, around the world.
The Trump administration argues that considering habitat destruction strays too far from the letter of the law. Instead, the proposal would only prohibit harmful actions directed against a particular animal, not their habitat. That could make it easier to log, mine, and build on lands that endangered species need to thrive.
If you're a prairie chicken in the Southwest and there's an oil and gas developer and they want to destroy your prime breeding display grounds as a, you know, and the bird can't mate, well, you're not actually killing them. You're not harming any of them directly. All you're doing is taking away their breeding ground.
But in effect, that will harm the species, Hartle says. Scaled up, this rule change would threaten decades of conservation progress for hundreds of species.
Any conservation gains they were making now will be sort of reversed, and we're going to see losses again in species.
The rule isn't yet finalized, and the public has 30 days to comment on the proposed change. And even if the rule is finalized, it will almost certainly be challenged in court. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Wow. Interesting. Fire emoji. Those are some of the ways that Elon Musk commonly interacts with other accounts on his social media platform X. But NPR's Ho-Jing Nan dug a little deeper, and she found out the tech billionaire has a favorite account. Here's her story about how that account is capitalizing on its influence.
Elon?
Is this just me talking, or is this a dialogue?
It's a... well, it's a pleasure to have you.
That's Mario Nofal, an Australian crypto entrepreneur. Nofal got his first boost from Elon Musk when he hosted that live audio chat on X in 2022. Musk joined the conversation about the collapse of cryptocurrency exchange FTX. This appears to be the first time the two spoke in public.
What's your thought on Twitter's impact on citizen journalism and the impact of citizen journalism on crypto?
So it's like, I think we want to just elevate the voice of the people.
Nowadays, Musk prolifically reposts quotes and replies to Nofal's account. Between August of 2024 and early April, Musk interacted with Nofal at least 1,200 times, more than any other account in NPR's review. X and Musk did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Sometimes, Nofal's posts jump via Musk into President Trump's feed. Nofal once repeated a false claim in a week-old post that alleged that the newswire Reuters was engaging in mass social deception. The post refers to a government contract involving a different company that shares a parent with Reuters. Within minutes, Musk reposted the false claim and President Trump repeated it the next day.
Nofal is the prime example of news brokering, which means that they are an alternative news source of curating and disseminating information about a daily situation.
That's University of Washington researcher Mutt John Bayar. He tracked Nofal's popularity after Hamas's October 7 attack on Israel. Nofal posted prolifically about the attack and regularly shared unverified information. In the first 3 days, his post got more than 300 million views. That eclipsed established news outlets including the BBC, CNN, and the New York Times.
The six most viewed legacy media accounts, they gathered cumulatively in total around 100 million views, third of what Nofal got.
That's despite the news outlets having more followers on X and actual news gathering resources. In an interview with NPR, Nofal said his posts were written by a team and they did not vet the claims they posted.
Do we know if there's real tunnels under a certain hospital? Do we know if there's soldiers in the hospital? How the hell can I know? It's impossible to know. Even if I had a reporter on the ground, they probably wouldn't be able to find out the truth.
Israel has mostly bought reporters from Gaza. Nofal says he tries to reflect many sides of the issues he posts about. He says it's different when it comes to American politics.
I used to be balanced on everything, and now I've taken a few stances. Free speech is one, and I've become more critical of the last administration and more supportive of the Trump administration.
The live interview show he hosts on X has many prominent pro-Trump guests. Like Musk, they allege that conservative voices have been unfairly censored by social media companies and other institutions. The non-Americans Nofal has interviewed include five sitting presidents and prime ministers. All those interviews happened after Musk started his job at the White House.
I just had a discussion with President Lukashenko. This is the first time the president had a discussion with what he called the new media.
The Kremlin invited three bloggers to interview its foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, in February. Nofal was one of them.
Do you think there's a possibility of, in the next, let's say, 10 years, of not only normalization of relations between Russia and the U.S., but back to an alliance between the two countries in the next 10 years? That's something already people are talking about.
Many of his big interviewees have been pro-Russian, though not all. Regardless of their point of view, Nofal doesn't interrupt or push back against his guests and publishes the interviews unedited on X on YouTube. Nofal says he gets prominent guests because his account has a big audience, and also
media outlets just don't represent them the same way. Like, any media outlet would not represent President Xi Jinping the same way they would represent, you know, the leader of NATO or the leader of France.
Nofal says he does not take sponsorship money for what he calls his political shows, but he says the exposure pays off in other ways.
When I interview presidents or prime ministers, it brings a lot of eyes to my channel. You know, that's top of the funnel. And then later that audience could later listen to your finance show, your AI show.
Those shows, Nofal says, brings deals to his crypto incubator and a part of what the company offers its clients. He wouldn't say more about money, but he says that trust and attention are scarce commodities, and that is what he's after. Huo Jingnan, NPR News.
More than 1,200 concerts have taken place here at NPR headquarters, right here in Washington, D.C., where artists squeeze into a tiny desk area while journalists file stories an arm's length away. American singer-songwriter Laura Gibson was the first to take the tiny stage in 2008.
The day I'll be another waking shadow cast on the covers of your bed.
Since then, it's become an internet sensation with a dedicated fan base. And this weekend, the Tiny Desk became a radio show, only on public radio stations across the country. With us now is Anna Maria Serre, one of the co-hosts of Tiny Desk Radio. Hey, Anna Maria.
Hey, Miles. How's it going?
It's fantastic. It's great to have you here. And I feel like I want to start at the beginning because this feels a little bit like a normal part of working at NPR now. Just I'm at my desk and then like Sabrina Carpenter or Usher walks by. But can you talk us kind of through the history? How did the Tiny Desk begin?
Yes, I love to get into the lore. So I think a weird thing that most people don't realize is that this whole thing came to be very organically. So two of my coworkers, Stephen Thompson, Bob Boylan, they were at South by Southwest one year. They couldn't hear the show. And they were like, what if we just invite the artist Laura Gibson to come play literally at our office, which I don't know why no one else before ever had this idea. To me, it's like the most brilliant scheme ever. But since then, it pretty much just kept going. I think that the reason it grew so quickly is because people could feel the organic, the authentic nature of what we do, what artists do behind the space. And so from there, it just has become kind of this pillar for artist careers, where it's really an opportunity for the likes of all kinds of artists, big and small, to come in and really prove who they are musically, to show something that people don't usually get to see. So I think it's just kind of infectious, the energy, and people can feel that, and then they want to be a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's an internet staple at this point. I feel like when I tell people I work at NPR, a lot of times the first thing they say is like, oh my God, you get to go see the Tiny Desk. But not everything that works online works on the radio and vice versa. And I wonder how you're thinking about bringing this show to the airwaves now.
Yeah, I think because the Tiny Desk lives on YouTube, a lot of times people think of it as a visual platform. But to me, really, the shining, most important and unique element of the Tiny Desk is still the audio. The idea is to keep the arrangement, to keep the instrumentation really stripped back, really as close to what the original music, melody, lyricism was supposed to sound like, so we can really give artists a moment to let their core musically shine. So in that sense, stripping away the visual, having it on the radio actually fits quite nicely, because I think a radio audience is really ready to kind of give the audio that beautiful attention that these mixes deserve.
Well, yeah, that's, I want to dig into the audio a little bit more, because you've produced some of the most successful Tiny Desks in recent years. Most recently, the Bad Bunny Tiny Desk that came out like less than 2 weeks ago and already has like 9 million views on YouTube. What does make the kind of performances special when you strip away all the kind of extra production that people normally hear when they hear a lot of these artists' music?
You know, we're in a really exciting moment musically around the world where production is such a huge part of the art form of music, right? Like, you have all of these incredible pieces of sound that are not just the melodies, that are not just the lyrics, but are that the actual, all of that sound around, all the exciting electronic sound, you name it, it makes it what it is. And I think that's incredible and it has its place. But what Tiny Desk does is it gives these artists the opportunity to come in and actually just say, hey, this is my heart. This is where I was when this first came to be, whether when I first wrote those lyrics down on the page or I first just had that melody occur to me in my dream or whatever it was. And I want to give it to people. And I think that really is something important and valuable and a little bit lost, not in a bad way, but just something that we don't always get to experience at a recording. And so what we really get to do is give people this opportunity to see their favorite artists, to see and hear those sounds that they're crying to at their bedroom, experiencing them in a more authentic, a more rich and more original way. And that is something that I think everyone can find something to grab onto.
That's NPR's Anna Maria Serre, one of the co-hosts of the new Tiny Desk Radio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For Saturday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. We're back tomorrow and hope you'll join us. Until then, have a great night.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the University of Buffalo, the University of Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.